This is the Light in the Attic podcast. I'm Jackie Allen. Today we're talking about Songs from Suicide Bridge, a recent reissue of ours of a 1984 folk album by David Kaufman and Eric Kabor. We've got Patrick McCarthy here, producer of this album and project manager here at Light in the Attic.
My story for finding Suicide Bridge goes back a few years. Before I started working at Light in the Attic, I was selling records on eBay and kind of just doing that stuff. And one day I had a save search for loner folk or for downer folk. It was some sort of keyword search like that. And an email came in from eBay and it said, your search for loner folk returned one title, which is kind of funny. That's how many it would show up. And I clicked on it because it said Songs from Suicide Bridge, and I thought, wow, that sounds really interesting. And so I clicked on it, and it took me to the listing, and I had never seen this cover before. I'd never heard anything about this person or this artist, and I was just immediately intrigued by the album title and the album cover, and I thought, there's no way this album can be bad. I tried to YouTube search for anything on the internet. I couldn't find any audio clips of it, and so I had no idea what it sounded like. And it was like, at that time, I think about $100 with the bids. And so it just kind of became an obsession for me. I was trying to figure out what this record sounded like, and then eventually the auction ended pretty like in maybe 300 range, and I didn't pay that much, so I didn't get it. And there was basically a number of years of me trying to find someone that actually had the record that I could play it and I could see what it sounded like. So fast forward a couple years, and luckily a great friend of ours, a guy by the name of Jeffrey Weiss, who's a really amazing record collector and one of the nicest guys in the world, we were just talking one day, and I mentioned that I'd been looking for this album, Songs from Suicide Bridge, and he said, oh yeah, I got that in the dollar bin at Rockaway Records in the 90s. And I said, wow, can I borrow it? Because I have to hear it. And he lent me the record, And I took it home and I finally played it, and it was amazing. It was like, it was one of those things, like I was hoping whenever each song ended, I was hoping that the next one wasn't going to be bad, so it would ruin the record. Because that happens a lot, where, you know, there's a song that's really good and then that's it, that's on the record. But it was just every song on it was just devastating. And just this sort of songwriting that you don't, that is just kind of taken for granted in a way, I think, and not really appreciated as much with records in the kind of private press realm. So that's kind of where the story
begins,
because then there was the whole process of trying to find David and Eric. It was a long process. For the longest time, I thought David Kaufman was Dave Kaufman, who is a religious kind of folk singer. Huh. And it's weird because they have a very similar, they look kind of similar, and they have a very similar low kind of gruffy voice. And I spent months trying to find a contact for that guy, and I finally contacted his management, and they were like, no, it's not him. Because I said, is this the Dave Kaufman that wrote Songs for Suicide Bridge?
Absolutely not.
And they said, no way. And eventually, after a lot of just kind of deep Google searching and whatnot, Jack Sills here, who is the kind of does like music licensing stuff for Light in the Attic, he was like, hey, why don't you look on BMI? And he looked it up. He looked up the name of the album or a song title on BMI, and it came back with a return for a guy named Eric Kabor and
Jackie Boy coming through.
Yep. Yeah. And Donkey Soul Music. And I called the phone number listed on BMI, and no one answered. And then I called back the next day, and I don't think anyone, and the third day, finally, someone answered, and it was Eric. And I asked if this was the guy, and he said yes. And
cool.
And I just kind of blew his mind and telling him my whole story and what we do at Light in the Attic. And he still lives in Burbank in the same place, the same house he lived in where they recorded Suicide Bridge. And he came by the office. He had the master tape still. We had amazing photos that you'll see in the release, and it was great. And we, you know, the record is such a specific release to LA. It has just this amazing vibe about it, and there's so many things that are related to the city and the feel of walking around in LA and being kind of lost in the city. And we really wanted to work with a writer that was going to capture that. And that's why we decided to reach out to our friend Sam Sweet, who's a really great writer. And we just knew that he would be able to capture the sense of place that is so important to this album with its attachment to the Colorado Bridge in Pasadena. And he just did an amazing job. It's some of our favorite liner notes we've ever had. And we're just really excited to finally share this with everyone. So enjoy.
So here's Sam Sweet with his liner notes and some songs from the album.
In the early spring of 1983, two friends walked under the Colorado Street Bridge, guitar cases in tow. Eric Kabor and David Kaufman had come to shoot photographs for their first album. Kaufman was an East Coast native who had never visited the bridge, but Kabor remembered it from his childhood, when his family would drive to the Rose Bowl from their home in Burbank. The bridge was an early architectural wonder of Southern California. When it opened in 1913, thousands waited on one side just to be among the first to cross it. Constructed upon 9 concrete arches, it snaked over the Arroyo Seco on a curvilinear path, allowing commuters to absorb expansive views of the surrounding foothills, as well as a harrowing 150-foot drop into the stream bed below. By connecting Pasadena to the northeasternmost corner of Los Angeles, the bridge served as a doorway between old America and the dreamy new capital of Southern California. Following its dedication, the Los Angeles Times called it a way of loveliness. By the 1980s, locals simply called the grand structure Suicide Bridge. In the 70 years since it opened, more than 100 people had successfully ended their lives by jumping off the edge. In one well-publicized incident, a distraught mother pinned a note to her daughter's coat, dropped her off the bridge, and then jumped behind her. That toddler became the only individual to survive the plunge, her fall broken by tree branches, a sandy landing, and the heavy coat in which she was wrapped. The bridge had given Cabor chills as an 8-year-old. He was unnerved to find it abandoned when he and Kaufman showed up with a photographer friend. They happened to visit during a brief window when the bridge was closed for repairs. While walking along the empty roadway, it was easy to feel that it had been shut down specifically for them. The duo squinted at the camera, scrawny Kaufman with his caustic glare, and Cabor, slightly doughy with curly receding hair that was partially compensated for by a tentative mustache. Both wore flannel and denim. They could have been a pair of escapees, the juvenile delinquent and the bashful runaway. They poked their heads through the bars of the recently installed suicide barrier and looked down to the stream bed below.
My daddy's working and my mama's in bed. Been there for 8 days with a pain in her head. My sister's strutting her stuff on the grass. Brother's out hunting one more piece of ass. But I think I'll write me a letter. I think I'll send it away to some lonesome loser who hear what I've got to say.
They had been playing together for 2 years. Each week they met in a converted utility shed in the backyard of Cabor's childhood home in Burbank, but they had yet to do any serious recording. Whenever one of them finished a new song, the other would be the first to hear it. More than collaborators, each was the other's biggest fan, and often his sole audience. They were never a duo in the conventional sense. Rather, as Kaufman put it, we were two loners who happened to join forces. They started out with dreams of getting a record deal, but after years of playing empty coffee houses around Los Angeles, they conceded defeat. Fame and fortune demanded certain qualities, and it became increasingly obvious that they had none. But between them, they amassed a repertoire of roughly 40 songs. At some point, one of them suggested, half-joking, that they should put all their darkest and least viable works together on one record, if only to spite the industry that had rejected them. It would be the debut that no one wanted to hear. When they started plotting a song list, they realized it was the record they wanted to hear. That was enough.
Night calls, rain falls, inside and outside my head.
The order of the day was Journey and Rick Springfield, Michael Jackson and Blondie, Kim Carnes and Hall & Oates. The local clubs teemed with punk bands and miscellaneous new wave outfits. One of the last folk venues in Los Angeles was located in the basement of the Echo Park United Methodist Church, a white Spanish stucco chapel hidden in plain sight among the burrito stands and car washes that crowded the intersection of Sunset and Alvarado. Each Saturday night, the church janitor, an ex-drifter and folk singer named Mark Phillips, organized a makeshift coffee house where anyone could play. It attracted frustrated songwriters, failed poets, and aging folkies, along with occasional vagrants and bag ladies who came in from the street to partake in the complimentary popcorn and coffee that Phillips set out on a table in the back of the room. He called the club the basement. If 15 or 20 people showed up, it was a big night. Eric Kabor occasionally dropped by the basement to accompany an old friend of his on guitar. Like most of the folk singers Kabor knew, his friend harbored dreams of becoming the next Jackson Browne. Kabor was too shy to relish performing. He wanted only to write and make records to hold and get lost in. David Kaufman was not the next Jackson Browne, which is what Kabor liked about him. On one Saturday in the fall of 1981, Kaufman appeared in the basement and was allotted enough time to perform only three songs. He dispensed with the slick showmanship and light banter endemic to acoustic performers. He appeared to care only about the songs, which he delivered in a sore but soulful rasp. As soon as his time was up, Kaufman packed up to leave, but Kabor caught him at the door. "I'd like to hear more of your stuff," he said. They exchanged numbers, and within a few weeks they were meeting in the backyard of Kabor's parents' house on Naomi, one of the flat, leafy streets near the Walt Disney Animation Studio in Burbank. Between June and October of 1983, they made slow progress on the recordings that became Songs from Suicide Bridge. Everything was recorded onto a four-track Porta studio that Kabor had purchased from a music store in Van Nuys. Being limited to four tracks forced them to layer instruments in unusual ways, and the machine only accepted blank cassettes, giving the recordings a ghostly, grainy texture. Once the song sequence was finalized, they played it for Kaufman's girlfriend. "So basically," she said, "you guys took all your most depressing songs and put them together on one record. Isn't that a bit much?" They decided she was right. The album would close with a new song, Kabor's One More Day, forming a counterpoint to Kaufman's Kiss Another Day Goodbye, its opener.
On the ground, but not for long. Another town, another song. Is it right or is it wrong? Can't tell for sure. Wasting time until it's gone. You play your soul for everyone. They relate until you're done. The heart is pure.
A handful of copies were sold on consignment at a few record stores in Los Angeles, including Aaron's in Hollywood and Turning Point, a small retailer in Glendale. They later had to return to collect the unsold copies they had left at McCabe's. They took albums with them to the basement and sold a few after their joint performances there. At one point, they were invited to play a house party at the behest of a wealthy patron of the arts and felt so ill at ease with the crowd that they ended up giving away copies to everyone who attended. They sent 150 copies to college and independent radio stations all over the country, hoping for some airplay. A few mail order requests trickled in, but the reaction was largely non-existent. They later came to accept that most of the promo copies probably ended up in cutout bins, although they did receive requests for additional copies from DJs in exactly two locations, Halifax, Nova Scotia, and Sitka, Alaska. The album was formed by Los Angeles, but its songs spoke to a drastically different climate. Seeing that Kaufman was burnt out on waiting tables at Hamburger Hamlet, Kabor helped secure him a position as a delivery man at Burbank Typewriter, the office supply company where he worked. Kaufman loved the job. It kept him outdoors and moving around the city, and he stayed there for 18 years until he moved back to New Jersey in 2001 to care for his ailing father. During that span, the pair continued the routine that they had developed on Suicide Bridge, and two additional albums came out of their nighttime meetings at Kabor's home studio. Kabor eventually married and had a son who grew up calling Kaufman Uncle Dave. After his parents died, Kabor moved into his childhood home, steps from the backyard studio that he and Kaufman had used for years. When the demands of raising a kid kept Kabor from joining his friend in the studio, Kaufman would spend nights in the little studio by himself. Suicide Bridge didn't change their careers, but it did change the music. They expelled something in the process of making the first album, and though they continued to hone their craft, the soul of their music was never as severe or as uncanny. "People would tell us those songs were depressing," said Kabor, "but it wasn't depressing to us. In a lot of cases, playing those songs in that little room was one of the only things that made us feel better."
It's been 27 years. Eisenhower was the man. Well, I was born in the springtime. Now I'm dying in. I remember way back when Mama cooked the meals. Papa went to work each day with me out on his heels. A baseball cap, a tennis ball, a life of running bases. Forgetting every reason, but recalling all the faces. I remember way back when Grandpa was alive. Every year we'd pack our things and take that lonesome drive. My parents in the front seat and the three of us in back. My sister's name was Linda and my brother's name was Jack. Jack. Thank you.
I remember way back when I was still in school. Tried so hard to make the grades and be nobody's fool. I even went to college till I had a change of heart. Hopped a plane for Hollywood to get a second start. I can't quite remember just what happened after this. Something about a future and the chances that I missed. I took a cab to Malibu and now I'm on the beach. What I need to end it all is right. Within my reach.
Thanks for listening. Sam Sweet is the writer and publisher of All Night Menu, a series of booklets about the lost heroes and miniature histories of Los Angeles. For more information, go to allnight-menu.com.